Very good, excellent. So here we go. So a talk, first of all. So many of you are already way off in the future and you don't understand uncertainty and impermanence. You think the retreat is going to end today. Have you not heard about the laws of impermanence? That sometimes we make all these plans and they don't actually work. And sometimes when they don't work, life gets much better. But don't make so much plans. You don't know whether the retreat's going to end or not. It reminds me of one of the stories which was in the book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, told to me by this New Zealand monk who was a monk in Korea. When they had retreats, it wasn't just 9 days. They were for 60 days. And they weren't the namby-pamby cream-puff retreats like here. You had to sit on the concrete floor, starting up, getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, maybe 10 minutes to go to the toilet, and then meditating 50 minutes, 10 minutes walking meditation, 50 minutes sitting meditation, 10 minutes walking meditation, right throughout the day, till about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. And even your food, you wouldn't get up to go and get your food. Where you were meditating, you'd have a little bowl and the food would come to you. You couldn't even escape from the meditation hall for eating. And when it got to 9 or 10 o'clock, everybody laid down where they were sitting. You had to sleep in the meditation hall as well. There was no escape except to go for an interview with the master. And the master never said very good, but always very bad, and hit you. So people prefer to be in the hall than go and see an interview. And this had to go on for 60 days, no chairs, full lotus on the hard floor. Now this was a young guy, so he's quite fit and quite healthy. But even after 3 or 4 days of that, his knees were hurting, his back was aching, and there was another 57 days to go yet. And he really thought whether he could make it or not. And the worst part, being a Westerner in these Asian monasteries, is you open your eyes, and you see all the Asian monks sitting there perfectly straight. And you feel, ugh. If I could only see one of them nodding, or one of them hurting, I'd feel much better. So because of his cultural racist pride, he carried on for another few days. And those days extended like weeks. You know when you're really hurting? And as soon as you can get up to stretch your legs and just do 10 minutes of walking, you have to sit down again and the pain comes back. It was so tough. 2 weeks went past and he just wanted to run away. But you know, he thought, what happens if you really endure something like that? You've done 2 weeks, and if you run away, it's like all that effort, all that endurance you've done so far is like wasted. And you feel, I've endured so much, I can go on for a bit longer. So he went on for a bit longer, enduring this incredibly tough schedule, until he got to the halfway mark, the 30 days. Now, when you get to a halfway mark, you think, well, I've done half, the other half should be easy. But it's never like that. The halfway mark, maybe in time, is 30 days. But in pain, it hasn't even begun yet. So that poor monk had to struggle on 31 days, 32 days. And when he went to sleep at night, at last he could stretch out and relax himself. And he fell fast asleep, and before he knew it, gong. And it was 3 o'clock. Now even the sleep wasn't much of an escape. And now another day faced him. 40 days, 50 days, only 10 to go. And when you think like that, those last 10 days stretch out like a month. But of course it had to come the very last day of the retreat. He woke up, only 1 day to go. Just like you, the last day. And if you think like that, the time gets even slower. Every meditation was going on like hours, even though it's only supposed to be 50 minutes. And even the very last meditation, this was the last meditation, He sat down there, only 50 minutes to go. And in those monasteries, they don't keep right the 8 precepts. So when the retreat was going to be finished, they had a feast for everybody. You know, a huge feast, and even better, hot baths. You know those Korean hot baths? This was actually in Korea. Those beautiful hot baths, you can just go sit in there and relax, and all the aches and pains could go away. And he was just dreaming of those hot baths and that, you know, wonderful feast for the end of the 60-day retreat, which was waiting for him. He could almost smell it. But, you know, that was only for a second, and the pain came in. And it came and came. Oh, when's going to be the hot baths? Pain. 60 days of sitting for such unnatural position for a Westerner. And of course, even though you're not supposed to, he opened his eyes to look at the clock. He couldn't believe only 5 minutes has gone past. It must have been an hour. So he closed his eyes again, and he opened his eyes. Only 6 minutes have gone past. And that's when he told me, he thought, you know, maybe the batteries were running out in the clock. And then he had this terrible thought, which hit him like a dagger. What if the batteries actually died in that last sitting? And the teacher never realized the clock. And he was thinking all these really bad thoughts and just enjoying, and I was just, he said it was the longest 50 minutes of his life. Now that last meditation, but of course, all things must pass. And then the master, the teacher, rang the gong. And he thought, actually, amazing, when you've done something like that, all the pain just vanishes and you feel this great wave of joy coming through your body. He's achieved something, he's done it, he's made it. Bring on the hot baths. And then the master rang the gong again. He said, I have an announcement to make. Many of you in your interviews have been telling me how beneficial this retreat has been and how you've advanced in your spiritual journey. And a few of you have suggested that we extend this retreat for another couple of weeks. Having considered your request compassionately, I grant it. We'll meditate for another 2 weeks. Cross your legs and carry on meditating. This actually happened. And this guy, he crossed his legs, he had no choice. But he said he never felt any pain. Amazing. All he felt is sheer anger. And the only thing he's thought of is trying to find out who these damn smart aleck monks were and what he was going to do to them after he found out. He was consumed with rage and pathological, homicidal mania. And then, gong. The bell went again. And about 15 minutes have passed by, like in a second. And then the master said, retreat over, go and get your hot baths. And this poor Korean monk, this is his first retreat, so what's going on? Is it over or is it going on? You know, like especially Westerners, you want to know what's going on. You know, you want to get it all planned. When are we finishing? When are we starting? And you know that, you know, weeks beforehand. You want to get it all figured out. So he said, well, what's going on? Are we meditating or are we not meditating? Now one of the senior monks came up to him and said, the master, he does the same joke every year. And this monk said he learned more in that last 15 minutes than he'd learned in the whole 60 days of the retreat. Just how anticipation and plans created all that pain. Only one day to go. That is painful. Only one meditation to go. Yeah, it's over. And then it's not. Have you ever suffered like that? So, many of you during your interviews have told me this is a wonderful. So why not carry on, okay? So I'll cancel all the flights and meditate a bit longer. But this is what happens when we lose sight of how planning causes so much suffering in our lives. The other story was of this fellow. He came and told me this personally I think in Bodhinyana some years ago, one of these events which changed his life. You know, he was doing business in Mumbai, and after the business was finished, he went to catch his flight, I think it was to Europe somewhere. He caught a taxi from the airport, leaving plenty of time, like many of you are concerned whether you get to the airport in time. And this was in Mumbai with a lot of traffic. And the taxi driver was one of these people who had migrated from the countryside, who hadn't a clue where things were in Mumbai, not even the airport. So after leaving the hotel, take me to the airport, yes. If a taxi driver says that, you know, they mean no. They don't know where they're going. And so he was getting lost in the streets of Mumbai. The taxi driver was going round and round in circles. The time was ticking away, and he was getting more and more concerned that he'd miss his flight. And still he was nowhere closer to the airport than the hotel after an hour. And he got very agitated and started shouting and screaming at the driver. Of course, soon, with his assistance, they managed to find their way to the airport. But it was really, really, you know, touch and go whether to make his plane. He realized eventually that the only way he could catch his plane would be if it was delayed, which was very common in those days. But when he came close enough to the airport, he realized his plane was not delayed at all, because he actually saw it take off. That was his plane, and he'd missed it. And did he give the taxi driver, you know, a serve of anger? He cursed that taxi driver. Of all people in the city, you should know where the airport is, the international airport. You stupid taxi driver, I'm not going to pay you, I'm going to report you, I'm going to... And as he was shouting the taxi driver, he saw his plane, on which he should have been on, come crashing down to the ground and exploding in a fireball, with every person on board killed. You wonderful taxi driver, I love you so much. Here, take $100 tip to one of us. And that was actually a true story which he told me. You know, he got so angry about losing his flight until he saw that it saved his life. So that's some of the plans we make when they don't work out. Maybe it is for the better it doesn't work out. So don't have too many plans. That's something I hope you've learnt on this retreat. You have tentative plans. So if you have a flight to catch, be prepared to miss the flight. Can you do that? Can you be prepared to adjust to things which are out of control, which is like your life? Can you learn how to let go and let life happen without always trying to control it and be a control freak? I've missed my flight so many times. I've missed my flight a couple of times. I'm still here. Life goes on. It's not the end of the world. In fact, I remember one time I missed a flight. I was again going to Indonesia to give a series of talks. You know, big auditoriums, lots of people coming, advertised, and so many people working hard to organize these things. And I turned up to Perth Airport, it was the Garuda flight. It was cancelled. The next flight won't be for another 24 hours. Oh my goodness. I can't go to... Actually, we found out why the talk was cancelled. Oh, why the flight was cancelled. You know, it was... You know, Garuda means this mythical bird. And that's the time there was bird flu in Indonesia. So we figured out Garuda had caught bird flu and was grounded for... So you couldn't go... Okay, people were disappointed. We can give another talk another time. At least my main title of the talk was uncertainty. There you go. This is actually showing you what I was about to teach. You all came there for a talk on uncertainty, and I taught it. So... when you've learned something from this retreat, because people keep on saying, how should I practice when I get home? It's not so much about spending time sitting on your cushion or doing walking meditation. It's all the beautiful teachings, the insights which you think, I have to do insight meditation. Insight has happened during this retreat, whether you like it or not. You've learned a little bit about not making plans, being in the present moment where life is happening. You've learned how to let go and let life happen, rather than always being so afraid you have to control it and think, oh, if I don't make my flight, terrible things will happen. That's just fear. It doesn't happen. You know, it's much better things happen, or sometimes worse things happen than you expect, but it certainly never happens exactly as you expect. Life is always a series of unexpected moments, which makes life interesting. And we try to plan it and force it into following our agenda and following what we want to happen, and therefore we just miss the beauty of life. The beauty of life is the unexpected when it happens, and enjoying the unexpected, making use of the unexpected, rather being so disappointed you don't realize that missing your flight has saved your life and opened up so many wonderful other opportunities for you in your life. So, don't be afraid of facing the future without any plans. Just like me, whenever I give a talk, I never know what I'm going to talk about. If I knew what I was going to talk about, I'd be so bored. Because I've talked about everything I could think of so many times. Every joke I've told so many times. But I just let them change from time to time. So you don't have any plans and things change, and you get a new twist on things, which is the wonderful way of not planning, being creative, and allowing the future to evolve, rather than you always driving it in your particular direction. And even if you get lost, getting lost when somebody drives me somewhere and we get lost, I always praise them, because I've never seen that part of town before. You always have a much, much, much better time when you don't go on the correct path or the straight path. No one goes on the straight path to Nibbana or the straight path to Jhana. You go backwards and forwards, you reverse, you do many U-turns. That is life, and that's what makes it really interesting. Because if you just go on the straight path to Nibbana, yeah, you get there very quickly and you're enlightened, but you don't learn anything on the way. But when you go to the left, to the right, in other words, you go on the off ramps of the freeway instead of always going along the freeway, life becomes so much more interesting. You know, you experience what's off the path, not what's always on the path. In other words, you get a wider view of what the path really is. So when you do make mistakes and things go wrong, that actually makes you a much better teacher later on. Able to share with others and able to be compassionate to others because you've been down the off ramps of life. They actually make you a fuller human being. So don't always worry that, you know, sometimes you're not successful or you think you're wasting your time. All those occasions when you think you've done something wrong, you wasted your time. No, that's so important in life. That makes you learn about just, you know, what's to the left and right of the path. And that gives you a lot of wisdom and also understanding and compassion in life. So we're not afraid if we make mistakes. That's the other thing I hope you've learned here. Many of you have made many mistakes in this retreat. Many of you have come to the interviews and said all your mistakes. And again, what have I said to you? Have I ever said, bad meditator? Bad meditator. Have I ever said that to anybody? You've told me some stupid things you've been up to, and all I've ever said was, very good. Now, can you do that to the people you work with and live with? You know, no, your husband wakes you up in the middle of the night, snoring. Can you say to him, very good. You know, you slip over and hit your head. Do you say, oh, very good, I've hit my head? Can you actually? Because what actually is doing there, accepting, embracing this incredible thing which we call life. And you know, life and progress happens in spite of you. Oh, some people come on these retreats and I'm really going to go for it. I'm not going to mess around like all these other people checking their mobile phones and having all sorts of stuff, eating and talking with each other. Those aren't real men. I'm really going to go for it. And you get up early. Not like these people who get up at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. No, you're going to... you're going to get up at 3 o'clock. And you get really disappointed if someone's up before you. Ugh. And you say, not like those people that go to bed after the talk. No, you're going to sit up here. You're going to sit up here. And you're going to sit for a long time. And you do all this stupid stuff. And you're not going to eat. Or just eat small stuff. And you're going to eat mindfully. You're not going to sit on these tables where everyone's talking to each other. No, you're going to sit just in your own little bubble. When someone talks, you say, get out. Now, the amazing thing is, the people who practice like that, or people who practice, oh yes, you know, when they feel like getting up, they get up, and they meditate, and they just have a nice little chat, not just a small chat, middle way with their people. And, you know, they just, you know, check their mobile phones. I shouldn't say this, I'll say this at the end of the retreat, not the beginning. You know, some of those people make more progress, you know, than the people who go through it hell for leather, and they're going to get meditation no matter what. Ever heard about the middle way? It's a soft, gentle way where you go at your pace and you don't compare yourself with anybody else. Again, I mentioned spiritual materialism the other day. That is just such a gross thing which, you know I see in Buddhist groups and Christian groups and all sorts of other groups. Always trying to be the best. You know, my meditation is better than your meditation. So be humble. When everyone says, what type of meditation do you do? You say, I do the worst type of meditation. I do the lowest of the low type of meditation. Be humble. Just, what do you mean, doing the worst type? Oh no, you do much better than me. Let them be conceited. You be the humble one. And actually you are the best type of meditation is just being here. How can you do anything better than that, just being here? So this is being here meditation. And that's what you can take back with you. You know, on the journey to the airport or to your home when you leave here, remember that when you've left here, you have left here. When you haven't arrived at home, you haven't arrived at home. You're on the journey. So on the journey, always be here. On the journey. And I mentioned a few people, that's what we call the in-between moments of life. It's in the in-between moments of life when you've left one place and you haven't arrived at your destination. That is where most of your life will happen. And we throw away so many in-between moments of life. It's more likely to get enlightened after you've meditated and left your cushion on the way to the toilet. If you are here when it happens. The in-between moments of life. You know, you've given all that energy and impetus. You've got the peaceful mind. And what do? You throw it away. Because I've done my meditation now I'm going somewhere else. Don't go places. Be a person who's arrived. Just like I remember seeing on those, somebody gives me these newspapers and these glossy magazines, and if you got your photo on the front of the magazines, they say, he's arrived. Have you ever seen that? You know, the film stars, the beautiful people, they've arrived. Arrived at what? Me, I've already arrived. Here. Have you arrived? Are you back home yet? You already arrived back home. Home is where you are in this moment. So what do you mean you're going home this afternoon? You always were home. Home is here. And too often we always run away from home. And as we're running away, we're in these in-between moments and, you know, we've lost our home. The home is now. This is where you live. This is your abode. This can be a place of peace and comfort. Just being here. So that's why when a couple of years ago, when I was really busy, and one of my friends, he saw me carrying a lot of papers going into the office in our centre in Nollamara in Perth. And quite kindly he said, Ajahn Brahm, how are you? And I said to him, I'm getting there. just like some of you sometimes say. How's your meditation? I'm getting there. How's your packing of your things? I'm getting there. How's your life? I'm getting there. And that's what I said to him, I'm getting there. And that's when he caught me out. He said, where precisely is it that you are getting to? And sometimes I thought, oh my God, he's got me. And I reply with all honesty, where I'm going, I know where I'm going. There's only three places in Perth where you can go. It's Karrakatta, Fremantle or Pinneroo. Those are the three crematoriums in this city. I said, that's where I'm going. I haven't got there yet, thank goodness, but that's where I'm getting there. That's where you're getting to. You're getting to your grave. So is that a nice thing to say? How are you? Oh, I'm getting there. No. So from these days, I always change my answer. When people say, how are you? I don't say, I'm well, or I'm sick, or I'm busy, or I say, I'm being here. That's a lovely answer, because that's the opposite of getting somewhere. So when people say, how are you? I'm being here. How was the retreat? I don't know, that was a long time ago. So I'm just being here, that's all. So if you can learn that, which hopefully you've learned from this retreat, you've learned how to be here. Instead of trying to get into any deep meditation, in trying to get to Nibbana, in trying to get to somewhere, you're always getting there. And if you still haven't understood that, you haven't understood what meditation is, and you never achieve enlightenment, if you're always trying to get to enlightenment, stop trying to get somewhere, be here. And when you're being here in your meditation, those of you who've done that, you're being here, it's amazing, your meditation is just so peaceful when you're being here. When you're going somewhere, it gets very difficult. So how do you practice meditation when you go home? Just be here. How simple can that be? So you're having your lunch with your wife, just be there with your wife having lunch. Don't sort of think about, you know, don't go reading the newspaper while you're having lunch, or you know, checking on your mobile app, whatever it is, when you're having lunch. Just be here. And there's so many opportunities in life for being here. And there you'll find one of the secrets of peace. Yeah, you have to make plans sometimes, but make all plans rubbery. So you could, and expendable, so you can throw them away at a moment's notice. I tell people in business schools that. One of the problems with businesses, they have their strategic plan for failure. Don't have strategic plans. If you have a strategic plan, our strategic plan is to be here. And to be sensitive. You know, and adaptive to all the different situations which come from time to time. If you really want to know how that works in practice, one of the very simple stories, you know, which I learned when I was a kid, which again, one of those stories which changed my life, which I should have mentioned this in meditation, because it works in meditation as much as it works in your business, the very famous Emperor's Three Questions story. It's in Open the Door of Your Heart. Emperor's Three Questions, he wanted to find a religion, you know, which didn't have all this rigmarole and ceremonies and goodness knows what else. So he decided the only things he needed to know were when is the most important time, who is the most important person, and what's the most important thing to do. The when, the who, and the what of life. And some of you have heard that story before, so I'll go through it very quickly. It is, in the end, he found the answers with a little kid. And he taught him the answers to these three important questions. And I've told this to business schools, I use it in my meditation, I should have told you earlier, because this is how you meditate. When is the most important time? It's always now, yeah. That's the most important thing. So when is the most important time to say sorry to someone you've hurt? That causes so much suffering in life. You have the opportunity to say sorry. Look, I'm sorry I did that to you. I really care for you. I love you. Please forgive us. And that opportunity goes by and it never comes back again. And you live your life with regret. And sometimes people die and you can't say sorry. When's the most important time to say how much you care and love somebody? I'll do it later on. No, do it now. Get the important things done now. When's the most important time to be peaceful? When is the most important time of the day to meditate? People ask me that question. Should I get up early and meditate before I go to work? Should I meditate at lunchtime? Should I meditate when I go home? People say, you know, before dawn is the most important time to meditate. Other people say between 4 and 5 in the afternoon. When's the most important time to meditate? Is it when there's a full moon? Is that the most important time to meditate? The answer is, now is the most important time to meditate. This is such a simple answer, but such a unpracticed answer. Everybody knows it, but hardly anybody does it. Now is the most important time in your life. And why do we sacrifice this really important, precious time called now with all these plans, with all these memories of things you can't change anyway, collecting all the chicken shit of life? And it's crazy. What are you sacrificing? You're sacrificing this place where life is happening, where wisdom lives, where nirvana exists, now. So now is always the most important time to meditate. Now, who is the most important person? Oh, yeah, I'm spoiling it. I won't get all these other answers. I was hoping to say, Ajahn Brahm. Oh, teddy bear. Now you know the answer to that question is, it's not the King of Thailand, it's not the Pope, it's not God, it's not the Buddha. The most important person is the one you're with. The one right in front of you right now. What's the most important meditation object? The one right in front of you right now. Even if it's sloth and torpor. That is the most important meditation object for you. It's right in front of you. Right now. And that just changes people's lives. You know, this girl in Penang, and she told me that, you know, a few people listen to these stories and it really gets into them. And that becomes their philosophy of life. Just one little story like that. And it changed her life. She's working in some big corporation in Penang. And that was her philosophy. And whether it was a customer, whether it was a client, a supplier, or whether it was a boss, or one of her underlings, when they were right in front of her, that person was the most important person in the whole world for her. And imagine in business if you do things like that. You know, you've got a sort of a customer, and you're really paying attention. They feel that, yeah, wow, she thinks I'm important. You'll get the contract, you'll get the sale, and that customer will come back to you again and again and again. Because they feel respected and cared for. They're the most important person in the world for you. And if that's with, now this is really important for relationships. How often is it when you've been married or together for a while, you take each other for granted? And you feel that way sometimes, that, you know, when you started going out together, you know, she really looked upon you as you were important. And she acted and spoke like important. Now, takes me for granted. That is the end of relationships. So remember, if you're with someone, you may have been married to them for 50 years, 60 years. But when they're right in front of you, they are the most important person in the world. Let them feel that. Now you have a relationship. Because otherwise you feel, I'm nothing, I'm not important anymore. So, in most of life, that's such an important thing to do. And, what happens when there's no one around? Which is most of your life. Who is the most important then? Yourself, yes. So you are important after all, because you wake up alone. You don't have to be a monk. Even if you're married, if someone's sitting next to you or sleeping next to you, you know, when you first wake up and come to conscious, you're conscious of yourself before you're conscious of someone sleeping next to you. That time, you are with you. And much of your life, you're with you. So you become important. And of course, what's the most important thing to do? You know, what to do? And there's a beautiful answer, it's just to care. This care, this compassion, the mindfulness, to be kindful, that's what the care means. And it's a great thing, that's what we do in meditation. The sloth and top in front of me is important. I'm not going to reject it, take it for granted. No, you don't belong with me. It's important. So you're mindful of it, rather than trying to get rid of it. And what do? You care for it. Whatever the object is. If it's a limiter, it's exactly the same. Limiters in front of me, but the jhanas aren't important anymore, because the thing in front of you is the most important. And you care for it. Now, to caring is an incredibly powerful word, and to show how powerful it is and how sometimes people misunderstand it, that there's a lot of kids have grown up with me. I've been here for 30 years now. So their parents have actually taken me, taken their kids to the temple. They've even introduced me to their kids when they're still in their tummy as a fetus. And the kids get to know me. You know, there's one lady, her husband got a contract to work in Dubai. And she was really, really sad to leave Perth and to leave the Friday night talks. But she got a whole lot of talks, on the iPod to take with her to Dubai. And also she tunes in every Friday evening for the talk. And so during her pregnancy in Dubai, she wasn't allowed to work, so she was at home all the time. Listened to all my talks, for many hours a day. And then, she gave birth to her baby, and she came for a visit to Perth. And I always remember that she brought her baby to show me. As soon as I started talking, the baby looked at me. The baby had recognized my voice, because it heard me so many times when it was in the womb. And it's a wonderful thing to see that. So yeah, they do recognize these things. But just caring for people, this kid, he grew up with me, and he went to university and just wondering what to do with his life, and he was smart enough, he eventually became a doctor, and his first year was being an intern. He came to see me at Nolamara Temple once, really distraught. He was wondering whether he made the right choice, being a doctor, because the previous day, he'd tragically lost one of his first patients. Young woman, and maybe in her early 20s, it was under his care and didn't work out, she died. And he had to tell, this man, that the person he loved most in life was now dead. And now his two children now had no mother. And that just was such a difficult thing for him to do the first time. It just cut him in half. Imagine having to do that. And even though he'd done everything you could possibly do, people feel responsible. Now you always think in that situation you have someone's life in your hands and you fail. And he thought, I just can't do this anymore. And that's when I told this doctor, I said, look, if you have the imagination, if you think that you have to cure everybody, then you'll never succeed. You will always be a failure, because obviously there's some people just won't be cured. They're going to die. So if you think your main job in life is to cure people, you will feel a failure. But that's not the job of a doctor, to cure people. So your job as a doctor is to care for them. And that you never need to fail at. Curing, you will fail. Caring, you don't need to. So when I told him that, your job as a doctor is to care for people. And even if they're dying, you care for them. And they will die peacefully and happily, knowing that they've been cared for. And also I said, as a side effect, as a free gift in the cornflakes box, you will find you'll cure far more people than if the main job is to cure instead of caring for people. And he really got that. He took that on board, went back and became a great doctor. And how many times have you seen people in hospitals because you want to cure people at all costs? have all these interventions which are just so unpleasant and uncomfortable, because too many people in our medical system think that you have to cure rather than just care for them and let them die beautifully, being cared for, being loved. Now that is why caring is more important than curing. That is why caring for your sloth and torpor is more important than getting rid of it. That is why, whatever you do in life, don't try and cure your husband out of his, you know, terrible tendency to let off wind in bed at night. Don't try and cure him of that. Care for him. And it's the caring which eventually gets the best cure. So when we want to cure things, we want to get rid of it, change it, make it better according to how we think better should be. And that's not the meaning of life. In meditation it doesn't work. I want to cure my hindrances. You know, I'm always sleeping and sloth and torpor. I'm always twisting around. I'm always moving backwards and forwards. I've got to cure that. No, that's not what meditation's about. Meditation's for caring for it. If my body's moving around, it's doing it for some reason, I don't know what, but I'm going to care for my body instead of trying to cure these things. I'm going to care, because that's the most important thing to do. Now, not only does that work in meditation, of course it works in life. We try and get rid of things, they usually get worse. Remember the demon in the emperor's palace? Get out of here, you don't belong. And it gets worse and bigger. That's called curing, getting rid of the problems, driving out the difficulties, getting rid of all the people on this retreat who made too much noise. There we go, you're the first. blacklisted. Of course you don't do that, you care for everybody. It's amazing when you care for them, they don't tend to make so much noise. Cure them, you get them tense. How many of you, you know, just all these regulations and laws, like speed cameras. I mean, it's the most ridiculous thing to have speed cameras in this place, because soon everybody knows where they are, you know, except the stupid people. And all it really does, if it's a punishment, all it ever does is teach you how not to be caught. You don't stop speeding, you just know where you can speed and where you can't speed. You know where the cameras are. So, those types of laws don't work. If you want to cure people of their bad habits, care for them. Just like prisoners inside jail. You know, you try and sort of punish them to teach them a lesson. Oh, they don't learn anything except how to be more clever, not to get caught. But if you care for people, then they don't need to get sick, they don't need to make mistakes anymore. Same with your meditation, if you care for yourself, if you care for your sloth and torpor, say, you find sloth and torpor doesn't happen anymore. Or even care for your restless mind. I didn't tell the story of in my fifth year as a monk, fifth range retreat, I was off meditating in a perfect place, up in the jungles in the north of Thailand, really close to the Burmese border. And it was in the mountains, so there was hardly any people up there. And there was what I call the traffic problem up there. One day a week, a car would come up. You know, it would bring up any mail and take off any produce, like, you know, Som O, which was lots of this grapefruit-type fruit up there. And they'd take it down to the market, anyone who wanted to go down. Once a week the car would come, and that was all. And sometimes you had to be looking in the right direction at the right time to see it. That was all the traffic up there. And they had this beautiful cave, which I used to go and sit in for hours. So you didn't need to have an aircon. Just go in the cave, it's beautiful temperature. You know, I had such great meditation in there that to this day, you know, there was a bat, lots of bats in the cave. To this day, I associate the smell of bat poo with one of the happiest times of my life. So I love that smell. It's, you know, to me, it's gorgeous, bat poo. Because it's the association I have. I was telling the other the monk some time ago. The other smell which I really like is the smell of tar. And the reason I like the smell of tar is because after the Second World War, all the metal went into making bombs and stuff. So in the local park close to where I lived, they used to have wooden railings, and they had to paint them every year with tar to keep them from rotting. So I grew up with the smell of tar, playing with my friends, soccer and all sorts of other games in a local park. And again, to this day, the smell of tar brings back these happy memories. So those are two of my favourite smells, bat poo and tar. It's actually true. Every time you smell bat poo, it's fragrant. It brings back happiness to me. So conditioning. But so I had this beautiful cave up there, lots of bat poo, and I had such a great time up there. But not at the very beginning, because I was in this monastery by myself. The people didn't really want to bother me. All they wanted to do is just feed me once a day, and then bye bye. They were busy. I thought that was perfect. So I was meditating all day, but soon I got very restless. I started thinking and thinking and thinking. Now, you know, I know what you go through because I've been through it myself. You just can't stop thinking. And the worst part of that is what I call to this day unmonkish thoughts. I was still a young man at the time, maybe about 28. So I was thinking of all my old girlfriends, Fisher. I wonder where they are. I wonder if they're still free. I wonder. Stop it! You weren't that hard to contact. Oh no, stop it! And then all the times, you had hanky panky with them, and you could stop it. And then you had all these sexual fantasies and stuff. Stop it! And it was impossible to stop. And I was sitting there. I said, "Come, watch your breath. You're a monk." Yeah, but she was really nice. Stop it. And it was a battle which went on all day. Even though I was embarrassed about it, and I always loved being a monk. I've said that to you, and I really mean that. But these things kept coming into my mind, and I couldn't get them out. Do you recognize what I'm talking about? Now, I was trying, and I was getting so frustrated. And I didn't have a teacher to talk to, because I was in this monastery by myself. There's no mobile phones to call up Ajahn Chah on the emergency line. You just couldn't do anything. So you were stuck there. And after 3 or 4 days of just going crazy, the only thing I could think of is going to the Buddha statue, bowing, and asking for help. Even though I don't believe in any supernatural stuff, when you're desperate, you believe in anything. And I was desperate. And an idea came to my mind. It was just, do a deal. That was the idea. And for me, the deal was this, that I'd grant myself 1 hour every afternoon. And I remember it was from 3 to 4, where I could think of anything. And I wouldn't stop it at all. Even the weirdest sexual fantasies, imagining being in bed with your ex-girlfriend, anything would be allowed from 3 to 4 p.m. The rest of the day, I'd watch my breath and be a good monk. That was the deal. Sounded fair enough. Mind, if you wanted to think that sort of stuff, okay, I'm going to let you, but only 1 hour a day. The rest of the day, you behave. And it was this great battle still. My mind didn't want to do the deal. It wanted to search. I was trying to watch the breath, and these thoughts came in. Let's try and get them out. Okay, watch the breath again. Now they come in again. And I was exhausted by 3 o'clock. Because, thinking takes more energy than anything else. I was totally exhausted. I went up to my hut, leaned against the wall, put my feet out. Okay, mind, now is your turn. You can think whatever you like. Any sexual fantasy, old girlfriend, romantic, whatever you'd want to do, you can. I'm not going to try and stop you. For the next hour, no exaggeration, my mind watched every breath without missing one. It was so easy and so peaceful. And at first I go, what's going on? I try and watch my breath, and then my mind goes thinking of all these stupid thoughts. And I said, okay, stupid thoughts, you can come. And then my mind watches the breath. It's exactly the same as I say, when you're up here, you feel sleepy, you want to go to sleep. You go to bed and you can't go to sleep. Have you figured it out yet? controlling. Well, I was trying to control my mind, trying to get rid of those thoughts, trying to cure them rather than care for them. It was actually feeding them. I was trying to get the monster out of my mind. Get out of here, sexual fantasies, you don't belong. And that's why they kept coming. The monster grew bigger and more powerful. And instead, I said, okay, whatever thoughts want to come in, you can come in. Monster, welcome, thank you for visiting me. And that monster grew so small so quickly, you could watch every breath without any problem at all. Sleepiness, get out of here. I'm supposed to be meditating. And the sleepiness gets worse. You go to bed, I want to go to sleep. You know, sort of clarity or being awake, awakeness, get out of here, I don't want you, it's sleep time. And you get more awake. That's called curing. It's not caring. So caring is as beautiful as letting things be. And you find most of your problems in life just vanish. Sicknesses heal. When you're curing, you're going to fail. You're going to get so frustrated in life, which many people do, because you try and cure things rather than care for them. Changing things, you will always fail. Yeah, you'll succeed sometimes, but you'll fail. But caring, there's no reason why you should ever fail in caring for things. That is within your power. So that's how we meditate. So this is what you learn here. And it's not that, okay, how do I carry on my practice? I have to sit down and meditate for an hour, 2 hours. Yeah, please do that. It's important. But the most important part is what you learn, the attitudes, the different ways of doing things, looking at things. That is the most important part of what you learn here. You become far better human beings by what you've learned here. And sometimes you don't realize you've learned it. It's almost like tricked into you by you think you're learning meditation, and what you're really learning is about life. And it works because you do change, become much better human beings. There was this man in Perth, and he was, you know, always wanted to come on one of these meditation retreats just for the weekend. And his poor wife, she wasn't interested in Buddhism at all, certainly not meditation, that stupid freaky stuff. And anyway, it's a weekend. You've got to take the kids to their sport. You know, you've got to do those jobs I gave you to do in the garden. You know, we've got to do our shopping for the week. I've got to do the washing. You know, this is our work time. No, you can't go. She says, okay, darling. And he was this incredibly smart husband. He never argued with his wife. He just kept on at her. Every time there's a retreat, darling, there's a retreat on, can I go? No. Okay. Darling, there's a retreat on next time, can I go? No, mother's coming. Okay. And this wife got so frustrated that one day when he said, darling, there's a retreat on this weekend, can I go? She said, we've got to go to the post office, we've got to do this, we've got to go to the bank. If you want to be lazy and let me do it, off you go. So he went. He took that as permission. So off he went to the retreat. His wife was just apoplectic. But the point was, when he came back after only 2 days, he was such a lovely husband. So warm and cuddly and just so nice and helpful that she noticed a difference straight away. If you live with someone, you know the difference. And she was so impressed that he told her this. The next time a retreat was on, he didn't even need to ask. She gave him the money, off you go. Because she realized the benefit of it. You know, had this husband who was, you know, a bit of a handful, send him off to the retreat and comes back home, new improved product. Why is that? Because you learn these incredible skills, and you'll find that happens when you go home to your family. You'll say, wow, you know, you're such a lovely husband. No, go again. So I tell people in general, if you ever have trouble with husbands, Don't complain or argue with them, just send them off to the next retreat. You know, when they go back home, there'll be a new improved version. Wonderful. Same with your wife, she gives you a bit of trouble, send her here. After 9 days of meditation, this beautiful, lovely wife who never complains, who just, whatever you do, says, oh, very good, darling. That's sort of how it works. So, that's the answer to the question, what do? When you get home? Yeah, you can meditate, nice to meditate, but also remember just how to live life as well. Then you'll be successful and happy and healthy. Remember the three Emperor's questions. The most important thing to do is to care. The person in front of you, the thing in front of you, the job in front of you, you know, the journey in front of you, not the destination, not where you're going, not where you come from, but where you are, the in-between moments. That's the most important. And now is the most important time. So simple, but so incredibly effective in all parts of your life, no matter what you are doing. Now the most important time. The thing or the person in front of you is the most important. Well, I didn't mention to you that, you know, if he's by yourself and you get up in the morning, you know what it's like getting up in the morning? Then you have to go to work. You don't want to go to work because you feel grumpy, you feel tired. And it's especially that many people these days, they don't have a husband or a wife, they don't have a partner, they live by themselves. So this is my teaching for you to do in the morning when you first wake up. You get up, you stand up, and you can actually, please join me, put your hands out like this. Hands out, right in front of you. And please follow what I'm doing. Do this in the morning, especially live by yourself. Bring them in. That's the most important time. The one you're with, which is me, is the most important. Now I'm caring for myself. Now people think that's funny, but you know it actually works. So look, you know, if ever you're feeling down during the day, something's happened, you missed your flight, or you know, you've lost all your money, you've just got cancer, or you're going to die, whatever it is, try that. It gives you this big boost of happiness, brings you back in the present moment, and you've got some energy to face the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, as Hamlet said. So that is the last piece of advice. How to use all these teachings when you get back into the... back where? Where we already are. Okay, so that's a little talk. I know that somebody said there was a question or something they want to ask. Anyone want to ask any questions before we finish off? We do a loving kindness meditation and we finish off. Okay, well, you can catch me somewhere. Instead of doing your room, you can actually ask me a question instead. But don't tell Bianca I told you that. So let's do a loving kindness meditation. So first of all, to be kind to your bodies, stand up.